If he was drunk in your bed, Nathan, would you take off your nightgown?
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
It's the Gospel of Musical Theater. I'm Nathan.
I'm Peter. It's the laughter I remember, you know, Nathan.
It's the laughter we will remember. Yes.
Whenever we remember.
Whenever we remember the way we were. Do you remember the way you were? What were you like in college, Peter?
Were
you a Katie or were you a Hubble?
Oh, shoot. I was neither. I was the James Wood character, the nerdy guy.
You're the nerdy, what's his name? Fred or the sweet boy who, I mean, my sense is like clearly has a crush on Katie, but doesn't know how to move things along, and she clearly has no interest in him.
I would have had a crush on Hubble myself, but...
Well, yes, I think they all had a crush on Hubble. I think everybody's got a crush on Hubble. Poor Hubble.
So 1973, the year of Watergate.
Yes, indeed.
The film... I can't remember where this fits in the... We're kind of out of sequence in terms of when we're recording these, but this is after Hello, Dolly, before Yentl...
Before Yentl, yes. Barbara is still, she's at this point, she's sort of the, I guess Arthur Lawrence said she's the most successful Jewish actor in Hollywood.
Yes.
And he kind of wrote The Way We Were as a vehicle for her, but to showcase the fact that we can now put a Jewish girl at the center of a major Hollywood film and it will make money. That's a little bit. So there's a way in which The Way We Were is already... has a social agenda at its heart, which is telling a certain kind of story about a certain kind of person that up until now, I think Arthur Lawrence would say, has not really been possible because a Jewish girl has not been able to sell films in the way that now Barbara Streisand can sell films. So this is the fulfillment, the end of her contract with Ray Stark. He has her under contract to do three films. This is the third of three. He tries to use her enthusiasm for this project as a way of extending her contract in some very dodgy and manipulative ways that she takes him on in the autobiography. But at the end of the day, Arthur Lawrence wrote this treatment. She identified completely with the character he creates, Katie Morofsky, who is based on a couple different girls that Arthur Lawrence knew. One of whom you did a little bit of research on. This did he marry Eve Merriam, or were they just friends?
They were friends. I mean, and for those of you who are wondering why The Way We Were is in a podcast called The Gospel of Musical Theater, because it's not a musical, or is it? I mean, every now and then,
or is it? That's a structural question. There's a piece of me that wants to suggest. I think because it's Arthur Lawrence
that's
and writing for Barbara
my
Streisand,
point. Yeah.
The structure of the film is kind of it's a little bit of a musical structure, or you could very easily make this into a musical.
And I think it would make a really fine musical. So
I do too, actually. I think it could be a really interesting musical.
Just to remind folks, Arthur Lawrence, one of the, we've talked about him before on this podcast, but he wrote the book for West Side Story, Gypsy, Anyone Can Whistle, Do I Hear a Waltz. He wrote The Time of the Cuckoo. He directed Anyone Can Whistle. He directed Gypsy, both in 1974, 1989, and 2008.
2008, the new production of West Side Story. He also, I mean, more to the point, directed Barbara Streisand in her first Broadway outing, I Can Get It For You Wholesale. They did not get along. In fact, he was horrible to her. So she doesn't ever really, at least that I remember from the autobiography, kind of talk about how they made nice and, you know, kind of got together for this film, which seems to have, she seems to have had a really good experience with Arthur on this film. I think he did not have a good experience on this film, and that was mostly because of Sidney Pollack. They apparently did not see eye to eye, which doesn't, I mean, at one level, there's a piece of me that thinks, like, Sidney Pollack, you know, kind of straight guy. Pollack and Redford are sort of the straight movie. You know, Lawrence and Streisand are the gay Jews in the project. She's the intermediator here. It doesn't surprise me that not everybody on this film saw eye to eye, which in some ways is what the film is about. So there's a way in which I think, like, okay, that kind of works. I think Lawrence, you know, kind of walked away. Lawrence is also, this comes across in his autobiographies and some of his writing, he's such a bitch. I mean, he is such a campy queen and so cruel. I mean, just a really, my sense, I mean, I don't know the guy, obviously, this is unfair. He's dead now, I think. What a cruel man. I mean, what a mean, angry. My sense is, I mean, this is unfair, self-loathing. He really had it out for Barbara at certain points. And then in other points of his career, like, uses her. But my sense is, I mean, you know, he and Patti LuPone famously have never, you know, like, he's a piece of work. Arthur Lawrence is a piece of work.
But this is his story.
This is his story. This is kind of his story.
He wrote a novel about it. Barbara loved it. Then the whole, you know, Ray Stark controversy, the whole getting it onto film. It was supposed to be Ryan O'Neill. Ryan O'Neill and Barbara were breaking up. So it turned out to be Redford, who didn't want to do it because he thought that Hubble was underwritten, and ultimately got there. Rough cuts that ended up on the cutting room floor, including some of the best and most revealing scenes. But let's go right to Marvin Hamlisch, who the song became and is still a classic. It's in the American Songbook. It was the best song in the Academy Awards of the season that it was, that The Way We Were was in. Watching it just the other night, rewatching it, first time in years, there is music continuously through this film. It's a through line, and it's, you know, the way Marvin Hamlisch writes variations on the melody, The Way We Were.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it
almost works in that kind of leitmotif-y sort of way. I mean, that song has become so embedded in consciousness now. I don't know that we write, but like the way that he uses the refrain, kind of coming in and out of the film, almost as a memory device, right? It's in the moments where you're invited to reflect. I think the first time we hear it, Barbara talks about this in the autobiography. I think this is right. The first time we really hear that song in the film is in the flashback sequence, right? It's the kind of the college montage. So my sense is that music is tied to their college experience, right? Which is a time when Hubble and Katie are not dating. They're not even really in this. I mean, you know, they're people, you know, as in a small college where you're kind of aware of people who work in a different social circle. My sense is there's something between them. They do have a couple conversations, right? He gets her to cross the street. He's just sold a story. They're in the same class. He's the guy whose story gets read by the teacher. She's devastated. So they have these kind of, you know, he sees her protesting. That's kind of the scene where we really see Katie's, you know, like who she is, right?
Her activism.
I think it's they're raising funds to support Franco in Spain or something like that. She's the president of the Young Communists League. Let's get the politics on this right. Yes, Katie would feel very, very, very. This would be very important. And then she gets kind of lampooned, right? Like other people make fun of her. They hold up a little sign: "Any peace but Katie's peace." And she's kind of devastated. He sees both her passion, you know, the way that that moment is shot. You get the sense that he sees that she's being bullied, and I think he feels badly about that, guilty about that. To a certain degree, it's, you know, it's like he feels for her. He's also joining in the laughter, right? He's aware that he's on the side of the cool kids who are making fun of the Jewish girl.
Oh, gee, Nathan, is that the laughter we remember?
Well, I mean, it's the laughter we will remember. That's certainly the laughter that Katie Morawski remembers.
That's chilling to me in terms of the lyric of that song. If it's the laughter of belittling her, because I think there's also an element of class here.
Oh, yeah, more than an element, yes.
He is an Episcopalian, upper class, becomes a naval officer. He wears male patriarchal privilege like a medal, you know?
And it looks so good on him. Oh, my God. Naval uniform.
A young Robert
All
Redford.
In white. I'm getting chills up my spine. He's so beautiful in this film. He's just stunning.
If he was drunk in your bed, Nathan, would you take off your nightgown?
Well, first of all, Peter, I don't wear a nightgown. It's the nightgowns.
Yeah.
We will remember. He's gorgeous. He's wasp in every. And, you know, like Redford didn't want to do the film initially because he felt the character was underwritten. And I can completely imagine that, right? Like, there is a way in which Hubble is kind of a stand-in in the story for, I mean, as you say, patriarchy, waspiness, Gentile. At one point, Barbara says, like, what, you want me to take a Protestant cooking class? And she kind of, she names it. Very rarely does the film explicitly name the difference between them, which is basically he's Protestant and she's Jewish, right? That is the, it's so that, yeah. Yes, at one level, class, okay, race, at that point, right? Like, Jew,
yes.
Privilege. And, you know, in this is 1937 when they're in college, right? So we get the sense, we don't really know that much about their families. I get the sense that Katie Morosky is a first-generation college student. Probably she grew up on the Lower East Side or grew up in Brooklyn. She's probably second or third generation from, you know, Jewish immigrants. She's not white, basically, right? Like, this is a time still in American racial history when Irish and Italian and Jewish are not racially white. Hubble is white. He's WASP. He's from, you know, who knows, New England prep school. We don't, I mean, I'm making a little bit of this up. But that, there's a way in which the difference between them in 1937 is still a racial difference, right?
Well, and his whole gang,
yep,
who gather in that house, I can't remember what the name of it is, Beaker House or whatever.
Beekman Place.
That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, Beekman Place.
And they're all people of privilege who enjoy lampooning, amongst other things, Eleanor Roosevelt's buck teeth, right? And bad jokes, making fun. And this offends her. And it seems to me this is another sort of privilege class thing. If you've scraped your way up to get to college, you're working two jobs just to get through,
or
five jobs.
Yeah, she's working a gazillion
you have
jobs.
Passion to stand up as a communist, and then, you know, a big Roosevelt fan, but whatever. And you encounter this group of people for whom, and this becomes a line in The Way We Were, everything comes easy to you, Hubble, right? And it's not just him. It's his whole class. It's his whole cohort.
It's his whole world.
Yeah, things come easily to people.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it interesting? I mean, like, there is something very chilling about the line, it's the laughter we will remember, because so much of what Katie finds abhorrent about Beekman Place is the way that they joke about everything. And life for her isn't—actually, I don't think it is the laughter that Katie—if it is the laughter that Katie remembers, it's the laughter of being bullied, and it's the laughter of being in a room full of people who are making light out of something that you feel passionately about, and how painful that is for her, how offensive that is. I mean, there's not a lot of, and this is, you know, that's kind of what Hubble, you know, in one of their many breakup scenes, basically The Way We Were is just one big breakup conversation that lasts over, you know, what, 30 years, 20 years, 10 years, I don't know how long they're together, but they keep breaking up, and all of the film's greatest scenes are a breakup conversation. I think this is why it's such a Weeper classic. Anybody who's ever been through a breakup, like, you know, we respond to those scenes, which Lawrence writes beautifully and Redford and Streisand play beautifully. But in one of their breakup conversations, he says, you know, the problem with you is that you can't take anything lightly. You can't just, like, enjoy. That is characterized for us as as basically the reason why they can't be together, which is that for Redford, it is the laughter that he remembers. It's the laughter that he treasures. And there's a piece of me that wants to, you know, like, let's take that seriously. I don't want to just dismiss Hubble's way of being in the world, which to a certain degree the film wants to characterize as privilege. And there's a piece of me that thinks that's fair. I mean, you and I work in the world of Anglican waspiness. So, like, I want to take that seriously to a certain degree, as an indictment of whiteness, as an indictment of patriarchy, as an indictment of privilege. You know, he was like the country he lived in. Everything came too easily for him, and he knew it. That line does – it's Hubble's line in the story. It's Arthur Lawrence's line in the script. That line does incisively sum up, I think, the way that Arthur Lawrence and Barbara Streisand see this character, which is that everything comes easily for him. I find that situation fascinating and kind of compelling, because I think it's easy, and to a certain degree it's kind of cheap, to dismiss the Hubbles of this world as simply a function, as symbols of something, and not, and but part of what I love about the way that Barbara Streisand talks about the film in her autobiography is that she is compelled by Robert Redford. She finds him interesting, she finds the character interesting, and she wants to understand what he actually wants out of life. She wants to see a beating heart at the center of this person. That's the right instinct, I think, right? That's what makes the film, I think, work, is that Katie sees something in Hubble, and it's not just something she aspires to in terms of whiteness, patriarchy, privilege, although there's an element of that. It's not just the sexual attraction of he's drop-dead gorgeous. He's the pinup girl, right? Like, he's the symbol of every... I mean, in some ways, like, this is, you know, this is a little bit Fanny and Nick Arnstein and funny, right? He represents the world that she knows she, and to a certain degree, the world that she doesn't really want anything to do with, right? She knows she's wrong for Beekman Place. She hates Beekman Place. They laugh at everything. So yeah, it's not the laughter that she remembers. It's the arguments that she remembers. That's, I think, when she feels most connected to Hubble, is when they're fighting. I think he feels most connected to her when they're just, like, enjoying one another. And I don't know, like, there's a piece of me that wants to mount a defense of Hubble Gardner. I can't believe I'm saying that. But, like, in some ways, like, I don't know, it's too easy to dismiss him as not good enough for her or not brave enough for her or too caught in privilege and power to make it work. I don't buy that story. I find that way of reading this text ultimately unsatisfying. And I'm way more interested in complicated people who represent different things and pull out different things in each other, where one is not just a foil for the other one.
Yeah. And I mean, the complexity of intimate relationships, right? One of the thinking way back when the sex wars in the Anglican Communion were just simmering back in the late 80s, I was working with an education program, and we were asked to design a program which we called, for adult education, called Sexuality, Gift of God. And we did, I think, actually a pretty darn good course back in the 80s. But one of the things we talked about was intersecting intimacies, like when we become only defined by our gender and which gender we're attracted to. There is so much more going on in developing relationship than just sexual attraction. There's financial intimacy. There's political intimacy. There's religious, cultural things. And it kind of, you know, the image of the way a key works in a lock, all the pins have to drop, right? Mm-hmm, and it's, for me, the Katie Hubble conflict comes because they cannot share the intimacy of a social political analysis. They've got sex. I mean, clearly they're sexually attracted to each other. They enjoy similar things. They've got some shared interests. But where it gets into the world of politics, of social relations, of social justice, she cares about that with all her heart and soul. It is kind of important to him, but life has another.
No, he's compelled by people. I mean, that's kind of their final argument, right? Is that, like, you know, he's the political story gets elided in some ways that are unfortunate, you know. But basically, she's come back from Washington. She knows she's going to have to testify in front of HUAC. She believe, right? Like, it matters to her. The cause matters to her. She's willing to go to jail for the cause. And he basically, like, you know, what's the point? And he's not wrong. It's actually a very pragmatic approach. He says, you know, like, in 10 years, all the guys who are being thrown in jail for their political, you know, righteousness are going to be courted by the very producers who are blacklisting them. They're all going to, you know, they're all going to go out for drinks. They're all going to make passes at one another's wives. Nothing will change, right? He's a pragmatist. He believes that, you know, people matter more than principles, right? So personal relationships, right? Like, basically, I think what he's saying to her is, like, be a human being with me. Be a person with me. That matters more. Our marriage matters more. Our love matters more. Our child matters more than your goddamn principles. Yeah. And she says, no, people are their principles,
people,
right?
Like,
I
mean, so their
principles. I think you're right. I think basically this is like they both have an operational thesis of life, and they are not commensurate theses, right? Like those two worlds ultimately can't exist. And I do think the film does a nice job of not dismissing one of those theses at the expense of the other, right? Both of those I think are like legitimate ways of being in the world. Hubble is a writer. He's interested in empathy. He's interested in human connection. To a certain degree, he's the Christian in the film.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm a little bit scared to even say that. Is what Hubble is representing, you know, elevating the importance of the personal, the importance of people, I could go a little more theological than he does. The importance of the human body, the importance of personal autonomy. Is he articulating the gospel at the heart of this film? And what then, you know, this is a cheap way of characterizing them. What Barbara is, or Katie Morofsky, the character, is kind of articulating is then something that is much more, it's idealistic, it's potentially dehumanizing, it's potentially, right, like the most important thing are principles, which means she's willing to die, go to jail, or conceivably kill somebody for her principles.
Right. Well, it was the feminist movement that gave us saying the personal is the political.
Yep. And right? That's exactly what she says. People are their principles.
People are their principles. And, you know, I'm just reflecting on my own social history in terms of being for so many years in the church, a closeted gay man. And our argument, those of us, and they're most of us, because our jobs, our livelihoods were at stake, who said, you know, I'm more than my sexuality. This is a, I had a friend who used to call the way he was in the world in that time, I'm incidentally out, right? Like, and I'm gay, right? Like, but it was a second or third thing.
But it's not a piece of my public identity, yes.
And right. Then there came a shift where to not be out was actually a betrayal of integrity, right? This was a hiding that privileged me, but it endangered others. If I was in, you know, if I wasn't out of the closet, then those who were brave enough, the younger folks than me, who were coming out, who were losing their jobs, I was upholding the system by not being...
The fact that you could choose and could pass was a function of your privilege. It was a function of your cis male white identity in a way that other people, possibly people who were more queer outwardly than you, did not have the privileges that you enjoyed.
Can you be more queer outwardly than me?
Well, but do you, I mean...
But yeah, I
passed. But the way you were, right? The way you were, right?
Right.
Yeah, there was a different... And that I think that's kind of, you know, it's like Hubble has the privilege of being able to focus on people because he's beautiful, he's white, he's successful, he's a man. All the doors are open for him. Katie doesn't have that privilege.
Everything comes easy to him.
Yeah, everything comes easy to him.
Including writing, which really burns her ass, you know?
Yeah.
That he can just effortlessly write this beautiful prose that flows out of him.
Mm-hmm.
She churns it out. It's good. It's passionate. Yeah.
But it's not effortless. Yeah. And he's at a certain level, he's a genius, right? Like, and she knows that. I think he finds it kind of, you know, like he doesn't really treasure his gift in the way that she treasures his gift. She wants him to be the best that he can be. She pushes him. She pushes him ultimately too far. I think that he kind of says, like, the way you see me is not actually who I want to be. I don't want to be your image of, you know, of a successful writer. I want to do something different. There is something so interesting to me in this question of the personal, the political, and privilege, to put three P's all kind of in one. Yeah. Like, is there a way to defend Hubble's thesis, right? Like, is there something defensible in focusing on human relationships instead of, or maybe even over against, the power of principle? Is there a defense for, you know, for queer men who choose to stay in the closet and can and say, yes, that's a part of my identity, but it's not the only part of my identity.
Right.
And there's other things, you know, like you and I have both known many gay men who stayed married to women for their entire lives. And there's a piece of me that thinks, like, oh, God, this is not the place to adjudicate those choices. But I do have a lot of love and sympathy for those situations, because I think in a certain way it is saying there are things that matter. Maybe not more than principles, but as much as principles. And one of those things is I've made vows to this person, and I love this person, and I'm not willing to break my marriage for the sake of some kind of integrity that may not actually correspond to who we actually are. And more to the point, the way we understand God's call on our life.
Yeah.
I don't know about that, right? Like, that's a – so, yeah, I'm layering the sexuality on top of this feels appropriate to me because it's 1973, and I feel like all of those questions are very much at play in the world in which The Way We Were is being filmed.
Right.
This is the feminist movement. As you say, it's the beginning of the queer liberation movement. I think there is this kind of emerging – the kind of dawning emerging around power and privilege and how that all works. And there's a piece of me that thinks, like, gosh, that is still very much the world we live in. I mean, one way that I could characterize Hubble Gardner is he's the American conservative, right? He's the, you know, like, he ultimately, the system works for him. And while he might have a lot of sympathy and even sort of, you know, I think his political principles are probably very similar to Katie's, right? Like, he is going to probably, he's a fan of FDR. He's going to vote Democrat. He's a Hollywood screenwriter. And the system ultimately works for him. And I, you know, it's like, I'm sure you have people like that in your life. I feel like we are once again in an era in which ideology threatens to has broken human relationships in ways that can never be healed. And at one level, I think that, you know, yeah, that is the way of the world, right? Like, Katie's not wrong. People are their principles. If you stand for nothing, you know, like, you end up standing. I mean, another way of characterizing this debate is, I'm sure you get this pushback, right? Like, I would love preacher if you would keep politics out of the pulpit. That's
exactly
essentially what Hubble is saying, right? Like, yeah. When I come to church, I don't want a screed. I don't want political propaganda. I would like the gospel, please. And my response to that is, there's no, that's a political agenda, right? Like, the so-called politicless preaching is political. It's just a different kind of politics. It's a politics that says anything that makes you uncomfortable is off the table. That's a political agenda.
Absolutely. This was the great shift in the post-Second World War, where this is set in terms of the Christian church, the experience in the Third Reich of the German churches largely being silent, led to a theological revolution. Karl Barth and others who said, so Sarah J. Lieber, I think I'm saying her name right, in the Jewish Women's blog periodical, writes this: "The Way We Were might be an old film, but she wrote this last year, couldn't be more relevant to today's world. Much like in the pre-post-war eras depicted in the film, people today seem almost irreparably divided across political and ideological lines. The film wrestles with the intersection of love and political belief and comes to the conclusion that civility alone cannot sustain loving relationships where core principles are misaligned."
Yeah.
And Hubble is civility alone, right?
Yeah.
And in terms of, the rise of the right, the rise of Christian nationalism. I mean, if I were going to a church where the clergy were preaching some kind of Christian nationalism, I would say keep politics out of, right? Because it's in my view, bad politics.
Right. And that's really what we mean. When we say keep politics out of the pulpit, we mean keep politics that are not my politics out of the pulpit.
Right.
I don't happen to like your politics, so I don't want to hear about it from the pulpit, which is really what that's saying, right? Yes, of course, right? There are plenty of churches that I can go to where I, you know, like, the politics don't happen to be my politics. I find them abhorrent and less than the gospel. So
yes.
Yeah, one way I can frame that is, please keep politics out of the pulpit. The better way to frame that is, your politics, I find, contrary to the teachings of the gospel. So let's actually talk about the politics, not try to, and this is, I think, what the writer's getting at, right? Like, let's not try to keep everything at the level of, can't we all just get along, right? Like, that is the privileged response. That is the WASP response, right? Let's make an easy joke. To a certain degree, it's like, those are my instincts, actually, right? Like, as a Protestant kid, as a queer kid who learned very early on, a tense room can be diffused if you make a joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the laughter that Hubble remembers.
And the reductionism of love, you know?
Yeah.
I am increasingly intolerant to sermons which kind of end up with, well, you know, if we all just loved each other
a little
more.
We all just love each other, that's right.
Yeah, then everything would be better. And we're all just the same.
Wasn't Jesus
really
all about love? Wouldn't he just say, like, yeah, just be nice to each other? The world would be a better place if we were all just a little bit nicer. That's basically that's the WASP gospel, right? Like, the world can be saved through civility and niceness. And I think, right, like, there's a pushback, and I'll align myself with that pushback, right? I want it, you know, as somebody who serves a pretty historically WASPy congregation, right? Like, that has not served us well.
Right. And when folks come from the underside of society, they see the gospel in a completely different way than those of us, and I count myself, who come from the privileged side of the world. It reads in a whole different way. And not that Katie, as Dreisen plays her, is Christian, but she cannot tolerate injustice, nor the killing of people. It's the Spanish Civil War that she's on about. This is pre-Second World War. She has some absolute values and beliefs and convictions that are core to who she is. And I think my point is, they come from her lack of privilege, her coming from a less privileged part of America.
Yes, her identification with those who are marginalized by the system. I think that's right. I think the film doesn't put too fine a point on this. They come from her Jewish heritage. Katie's a prophet. Right? Like she believes that if you want to follow, if her theological principles, I would suggest are do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. Right?
She is in the tradition of Micah and Isaiah. Absolutely. Yeah. And Hosea.
This is the rule of faith. Actually, this is the job of a person of faith is to be a part of repairing the damaged world that we live in. And one of her principles is like, take no human life, right? Like at the end of the film, that famous last scene in front of the Plaza Hotel. Ban the bomb. Yeah, absolutely. She's still a her hair is curly again, right? Some of the conflict between Cubble and Barbara, you can read in terms of her hairstyles throughout the film, right?
Like she irons her hair out to look more waspy,
and then when she finally realizes like I'm not going to be able to make it work, she lets her hair go frizzy again. She's a Jewish broad with a loud mouth. That's who she is. That's who God has created her to be. Right? Yeah. Like that is the human being that God has created. Katie knows it. Hubble knows it too, right? There is a way in which, at the end of the film, they resort to civility. You know, like they see each other, they have a very sort of, wistful, I mean, it's a great scene. It's become such a Sex in the City, like riffs on this scene. Your girl's lovely Hubble, brushes the hair out of his eyes. I mean, like everything about it is like a knife to the heart. It's such a great scene. But it is basically a scene about civility, which is how former lovers who have a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of conversations that were never resolved, that's, like we resort to let's see each other in the street, have a few passing words. There's all of this unspoken stuff. It's such a pregnant scene for two actors to play. But at the end, he goes off with his blonde wife and she crosses the street and picks up her protest sign and continues her life.
Your girl is lovely, Hubble. Why don't you bring her for a drink when you come?
I can't come. Father?
Yes. Very.
Good.
So where that leaves me with is I find the line from the song, the lyric from the song, disingenuous. What's too painful to remember, we choose to forget. Like, I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's wishful thinking. I don't think she forgets a thing.
No, Katie doesn't.
About the breakup.
Well,
or does she? I mean, she still loves him. She's still attracted to him.
There's also the weirdness of the fact that he asks after their daughter, whom he clearly hasn't seen in years. So there is that, right? Like, what's too painful to remember, we simply choose to forget. And she's choosing not to say, hey, you sired a child by me and then abandoned me. And, like, maybe someday you'll reconnect with your daughter. I mean, I don't know about that. That piece of the film feels uncomfortable and weird to me, that they just kind of elide over the fact that these two people have a child together and Hubble is basically not a part of that kid's life. We don't. So whatever. That, I mean, that's a different thing. Has she, right? Like, is she choosing to forget? She kind of is. She's playing his game. She's not making a scene, right? Like, she's not being Katie, right? Like, calling across the street, like, Hubble, 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 sobbing, you know, coming over this ball of anxiety. Like, I'm so happy to see you. Here's the key to my apartment, right? Like, that's how old Katie, she would throw herself at him. She gets what she wants. And that's, right? Like, you push too hard, Katie. She says, yeah, but look what I've got, yeah. Right? The reason that she has what she has is because she pushes for it. And in that final moment of the film, right, like when, you know, when they see each other, she's cool and collect. She's more mature, you know. She's married, right? She's got a husband. She's, you know, I presumably he's adopted the kid. That, you know, but like she has a whole life, yeah. And that life to her in that moment is more important than rehashing old wounds with Hubble Gardner. So what's too painful to remember? She simply chooses to forget, and it's the laughter that they remember,
which is the painful part, right? That's where this song kind of turns on its head.
It's a WASP song. I mean, yeah, that is. Well, I don't know. Is it? Is you? I mean, here.
You. It's okay.
I mean, I'm 42. I don't know. It's like, yeah, when some of that is privilege.
Some of it's privilege. But I mean, my experience.
Some of it's just maturity.
My experience is, I may wish to forget the painful parts, but as I get more reflective on my life from almost 70 now, the painful parts keep coming back, and some of it is cringe. Like, oh fuck, I did that. Really?
Oh, that's too painful to remember. Let's choose to forget.
But that's what's painful from a person of privilege to remember are the cringe-worthy moments where I was just
hurt,
the people I've
the
hurt, the horrible things I've said, the horrible things I've done. And just to, you know, in relationship to the Christian practices of confession, absolution, this notion that forgive you all that is past.
Yeah.
I mean, I grasp onto that, but I just don't buy that Katie, maybe when she's with Hubble, the attraction is just so overwhelming and the history. Yeah. She can choose to forget it, but I just don't believe that.
You don't buy it.
I don't buy it. I don't buy it.
No, she's not someone who forgets she doesn't forget a thing. She's got a steel trap mind. Nothing slips past Katie. Hubble probably can choose to forget. There is a way in which the song is the song of the Wasp.
Yeah.
It's ironic that Barbara sings it. It's Hubble's song.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Memories light the corner of my mind, misty watercolor memories of the way we were, scattered pictures of the smiles we left behind, smiles we gave to one another for the way we were. Could it be that it was all so simple then, or has time rewritten every? I mean, that's what he says to her, right? Like, Katie, it was never uncomplicated. You know, she's the one who seems to have some kind of rosy image of like what it was
it
like for
wasn't
them.
Wasn't a happy relationship.
It was
combative. It might have worked,
Which is why it was happy for her, right? I think she's somebody who feels intimacy in combat. He is not. So yeah, he does revert to a kind of a misty watercolor memories. I think her memories are probably of how engaged she felt fighting and fucking him.
Yeah. And good God, I mean, she must have some feelings about becoming a single mother and raising a child on her own and him being an
that's
absent
a part of
father. Like, come on, give me a break here.
Yep.
This wasn't a misty watercolor memory. This guy really screwed her over.
Yeah. I mean, there's another way. I appreciate your moving. I don't know. Another, it's not the line. It wouldn't work in the scansion of the song. And I don't like the line as well. But another way that we could frame the theology of that song, or another way of thinking about that song, is what's too painful to remember, we simply choose to forgive.
I like that.
Which
that
is different than forgetting.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this does, I suppose, take us into the realm of Christian theology, which is not, and not just Christian, that forgiveness is different than forgetting, right? Like, the Christian theology of forgiveness is not about pretending that we're elephants and that, like, you know, when we've forgiven somebody, we must never think of it again, right? Like, it's gone. The pain no longer hurts me. That's not how forgiveness works. My sense is forgiveness is much more actually about choosing to remember, but do the work of setting aside the feelings of bitterness and rancor that are associated with those memories, and choosing not to forget. Actually, it's easier to forget. It's easier to seduce ourselves into thinking that we've moved on.
Right.
That, I think, as you're saying, right? Like, we learn over time, that's a temptation to be avoided, because really that's suppression. Wasps are really good at this, about not talking about stuff, pretending to forget, choosing to forget, but not actually doing the harder work of forgiving. And so maybe that's what's happening in that final scene.
I like that.
Is that Katie is able to cross the street and brush the hair out of his eyes because she has chosen to forgive him. That's how I want to.
Okay.
That's how I want to characterize that moment, which I mean, does feel to me like a more mature woman who knows who she is and loves who she is and makes no apologies for who she is. Also understands the ways in which, like, they weren't able to make it work at, you know, 18, 19, 20. I mean, my God, do you remember who you were with when you were 18, 19, 20?
Barely, yeah.
Was it healthy and good for your mutual thriving?
No, of course not.
Was it passionate and fiery? Yes, probably. There were moments. Was it filled with all kinds of weird kinds of self-projection and identification, because we're trying to figure out who we are? And so the way we do that is by mirroring, you know, like, seeing ourselves through the eyes of somebody else. She likes the way that she sees through the eyes of this waspy boyfriend. She, you know, like, she's the flousy Jewish loudmouth, but she's grown now. She doesn't have to, she can play in multiple keys. And one of the keys that she can play in is, I've forgiven you for the ways in which you hurt me. I've forgiven myself for the ways in which I hurt you, the ways in which I know I was wrong for you. I know I pushed you too hard. We can choose to forgive.
Okay. Yep.
And then they go their ways.
If that's it, that otherwise it's just a nostalgia. Right.
Right. And that's the danger of that song, is its misty watercolor memories.
It's a nostalgia that's not really rooted in the hard reality of making a life for yourself, of expressing your identity, of being, as you say, the person that God has created you to be for Katie. I mean,
And for Hubble, too, right? Like, I mean, who knows, right? We don't really get a sense of his life. He's with his newest blonde thing on, you know? So it's like, there's a piece of me that thinks, like, you know, he's going to go into the bar and get sloshed. You know, he's a man who fought the Second World War and is never, you know, it's like, there's a piece, like, I know that character to a certain degree. We've talked about that character.
Well, it's the Brigadoon character, the man trying not to cry, right?
Lonely men around me trying not to cry. Men who were taught, I mean, I'm pastor to many of these men. They still exist. Men who were not given a lot of emotional tools growing up in terms of how the world taught them to be men. So they mostly depended on women to do their emotional labor.
That's right.
There are lots of lonely men around me trying not to cry. Church is one of the places where they can cry. So it's like, that's, there's a piece of, I don't know, like, I take that work really matters to me, figuring out how to be a good pastor to people like Hubble Gardner. That kind of is my job. So I have a lot of love for Robert Redford in this film, because, like, I see him, and to a certain degree, like, that's kind of me. You know, if I'm in this film, if I identify with this film, it's not really, you know, it's like everybody who loves The Way We Were, at the kind of the deep level that the women of Sex and the City love it, identifies with Katie, right? There are two kinds of girls in the world. I think Miranda says to Carrie, you know, there's Katie's, and then I don't remember what, you know, but then there's the blondes, right? There's blonde girls and there's frizzy haired girls. There's Katie's and there's everybody else.
One word. Hubble.
Hubble. Oh my God. Hubble. It is so Hubble.
Who's Hubble?
Hubble. Robert Hubble Redford in The Way We Were.
Oh, I love that movie.
No, I love that movie.
Never saw it.
Oh my God.
What are you, an alien? How could you not have seen The Way We Were?
Chick film.
Okay. Robert Redford is madly in love with Barbara Streisand.
Katie. Katie, right?
Yeah. But he can't be with her because she's too complicated and she has wild curly hair.
Hello, curly.
Yeah. So he leaves her and marries this simple girl with straight hair.
Ladies, I am having an epiphany.
The world is made up of two types of women, the simple girls and the Katie girls. I am a Katie girl, and where are our drinks?
I always, always, always cry at the last scene of that movie when she sees him in front of the hotel with his new wife.
The simple girl.
And she reaches up and
smooths his hair away.
And she says to him, your girl is lovely, Hubble. And then the music comes in.
Memories.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Like the corners of my mind. Misty watercolored memories of the way we were.
Let me do my favorite part. Can it be?
Oh, yes, yes. Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? If we had the chance to do it all again, tell me, would we? Could we?
I think every girl who projects, and I think a lot of gay men who see ourselves in the way we were, we identify with Katie, right? Yeah. Like, we're misunderstood, we're marginalized, we have to fight for everything. We know we're too much, we know we're too loud, we know we push people away because of our intensity, and ultimately, like, we can't have the beautiful boy that we want because we feel like we're too much. So our best option then is to save dignity, brush the hair out of his eyes when we see him 20 years later, and say, your girl is lovely, Hubble. And then turn our back and walk across the street and leave him standing there.
At the Plaza Hotel in New York.
At the Plaza Hotel. But really, I think the person I am in this film is Hubble Gardner, right?
Like,
not that everything's come entirely easily to me, but those of us who have privilege, we need to take a really hard look at Hubble Gardner. Yeah. He is our avatar in this film. And the ways in which he loves Katie, responds to Katie, but also dismisses her and can't understand her. In some ways, I think that, I don't know, like there's something that I find really convicting isn't quite the word, but emotionally grabs me in this film. And some of it's Robert Redford.
Yeah. Well, and Hubble needs to understand Hosea and Micah and Jeremiah, right? Like it's the Christian need to read the prophets, the Christian need to read the scripture, not from the point of privilege, but from the underside, from the struggling, from the oppressed minority. And I think that's been the great project of the church since Second World War, that we can no longer just kind of lapse into Romans 12 and try to live,
or 1 Corinthians 13,
self-satisfied
reduce the gospel to love.
Yeah.
As a way of skirting harder conflict, which is mostly what WASP Christianity does. Not mostly, that's one of the things, that's one of the hallmarks of WASP Christianity. It's one of the hallmarks of Anglicanism, I mean, to a certain degree, right? Like figuring out one way that we could think about Anglicanism, it's a political compromise designed to keep Roman Catholics and Puritans from killing each other. Everybody use the prayer books, pray these words, and please don't, and one level I think like, any tactic that keeps people from burning each other at the stake, sign me up for that project, ban the bomb. At another level, I think it has not set us up particularly. I mean, you know this better than I do. It has not always set this communion up for being able to engage difference and conflict particularly well.
Exactly. And I don't think it's a particularly good training ground for living in the midst of culture wars that we live in right now in Europe, in North America. I mean, it's global, and our capacity not to be the passionate Katies and just say, for fuck's sake, this is wrong. It's just wrong. And while this may break my relationship with you, my principles are more important. There are principles worth fighting for now. There are principles at stake. And I am, as a privileged white male and compromise is not a bad word for me. I try to keep people happy. I am ill-equipped to be navigating through the particular zeitgeist that is now in terms of culture wars. If I get into a disagreement with somebody principled, I either try to, you know, as you say, you tell the joke, you change, you distract, you move to something else. And I don't know how we do that. And I don't think the Anglican sensibility is particularly helpful right now. I agree with what you're saying.
I don't either. Although, I don't know, Peter, like, I think about the work that you did in this church, staying in relationship with people who said horrible things to you, thought even more horrible things about you. and the ways in which you let the institution use you to a certain degree in a symbolic way, the cost that you bore in doing that, what I want to call your deep faithfulness in being willing to fight for relationships even over deep and wrenching disagreements, and your sense that there was something there worth fighting for, right? There is something valuable about staying in relationship with people who are ideologically opposed to your very humanity. Yeah. Now, what is that? I think theologically that's the principle that only God can change a heart. So I don't necessarily – it's none of my business how somebody changes their principles or change – maybe people never change their principles. Maybe we never change our core ideology. But my sense is one of the ways in which the Holy Spirit works in our lives is through people. So if I divorce myself from everybody who is ideologically opposed from me, I have no – like I can't change.
Right.
And then
the gulf gets wider, right?
The gulf gets wider. There is a piece of me that wants to say, like, I mean, that's the genius at the heart of Anglicanism. It's not just Anglicanism, but there is a voice at the heart of Christianity that says people over principles. The personal relationships really actually matter. They're sacred. They're not just convenient. They're not just a way of skating over conflict. They're sacred.
Yeah.
That's intimacy.
Yeah.
So I don't want to lose that. There's a piece of me that thinks Hubble is articulating.
Yeah.
It's very complicated. And I think to your point, right? Like we are now living through another age in which relationships are breaking down over, civility. Civility doesn't work. Civility only gets us so far. Anglicans have elevated civility to a fucking theological principle. I think that has not served us well. And there is also something to the heart of this tradition about the power of personal relationships and how the Holy Spirit can use personal. I mean, I think about, my parents and my family.
I know.
The only way that we, managed to get to where we are is by continuing to talk with one another.
Right.
Even over decades where, we were on very different pages in terms of the Bible, human sexuality. Not that everything's like hunky-dory now, but we stayed in relationship.
Right.
And I really treasure that. Now, to a certain degree, right? Like privilege, power, absolutely. We're a bunch of white folks. So yes, we have good skills for not talking about stuff, sometimes for decades. I don't always feel like that's work that I get to do with my therapist, right? Is kind of unpack all of my instincts as a white person, as a cisgendered white guy around avoiding conflict. There's also a piece of me that wants to say, I think some of that saved my relationships with two of the people who matter more to me than just about anybody else in the world. And I treasure those relationships. I'm not willing to sacrifice those relationships on the altar of principle.
Right. And so, I mean, it's the old conflict theologically between priests and prophets, right? Pastors and prophets.
Yeah.
The pastor's instincts are to hold people together as your family has held together, not because you've avoided things, although sometimes you've avoided things, but because
sometimes we avoided things.
Yeah, but ultimately, you are willing to hang in together. It was the phrase that I used a lot. There's more that we have in common than what divides us. And I hear the liberal voices, the progressive voices in society wanting to say that. I'm not hearing it from the other side.
Not
so
from
much.
Conservatives.
Not
I think that's right.
All.
No. Yeah,
not
no, there is, and that's the piece of me that I, it's like, that's where I see the danger of what Katie is articulating, which is principles matter more than people, because I think where that goes is I am willing to do violence to my neighbor for the sake of an idea. That's where I see conservatism going, right? Like I am willing to take up arms and storm the Capitol building if I don't like the outcome of an election. I'm willing to jettison the principles of democracy if they happen to go against what I believe to be right. And I'm willing to fight my brother. And Jesus has a lot to say about how I treat my neighbor.
Yeah.
So does the Old Testament.
Yeah.
How I treat the stranger. So I don't know. Like what we're saying here is like part of why I love the way we were is that at its best it holds the prophet and the priest in tension. It holds that as a unresolvable tension maybe. As a way of, I mean, basically helping us to navigate the potentiality of violence, I think, in our midst. And that, right, Katie, I think that is her core principle, right? First, do no harm. Ban the bomb. You know, like for a while it's communism. That seems like the peacenik version. She jettisons that, I think, as soon as the Second World War starts. She becomes a total believer in FDR. And, you know, when we meet her again in the 70s, she's trying to ban the bomb. For her, the preservation of human life is the most important thing. And that is I guess, you know, like if I'm going to, right, like, yep, that's a principle I can get behind, right? Yeah. Like if you find that your principles are leading you to do violence to somebody else, you need to rethink those principles.
So maybe this film gives an opportunity to reflect on social history, on gender roles, on privilege, on race, on pacifism, and on principle. And gosh, you know, in this conversation, I was wondering, why the hell are we talking about this? But I think the conversation...
because I wanted to, because I love this movie. And I said, I'm not doing a Barbra Streisand season unless I get to talk about The Way We Were. It's not a musical. It's true. It has a great song at its center. Yeah. It's structured a little bit like a musical. Yeah. There are five great scenes. Yeah. Every one of them could be a song. Arthur Lawrence writes a pretty good script, and he's a musical boy. He understands musical structure.
And it was, there was an attempt to turn it into a musical at one point.
Yeah. It's probably just as well that didn't happen. I don't know. There's a piece of it. Like, don't, you know, it's a great film. You don't need to mess with it. But yeah, does it belong in this podcast? I don't know. But in the broadest sense, I suppose what you and I are both interested in is where we find theology and gospel, where we find something that feels sacred in a work of art that has absolutely no pretension of coming from any sort of theological agenda. Because, you know, Christ plays in 10,000 places. And
yep.
Theology is way more interesting than the narrow confines of a church building.
I agree. Well, the laughter will remember.
It's the laughter, I suppose.
Until next time.
Whenever we remember The Way We Were. I'll see you next time.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @GospelOfMT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time.